From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Today, in our weekly conversation with Professor Luciana Bone, we're going to step away temporarily from our discussion of the history of the Soviet Union. So this week, we're going to do a little switch up, and there's so many contemporary issues that relate to this history that are popping up around us that we keep, you know, stepping out, particularly this whole thing with Russophobia. I mean, if we're discussing the history of the Soviet Union, and starting in 1905 or whatever, the West is very deeply involved in everything that happened in Russia and in the other republics as well that became part of the Soviet Union, and was very involved and probably the key in taking down the Soviet Union and then looting it in the 90s. And now, as Russia has put itself back together and reclaimed some of its own sovereignty, particularly the U.S., but also the Europeans, the colonial powers, they're all going bananas and ready to blow up the world over this. So we're going to talk, I guess, about some of the more contemporary things right now, and we can invoke some of that history, and then we'll get back to the history. There's plenty to discuss.
Very good.
Yeah.
Today, so we're going to talk about distorting Russian reality, the present day, and the pushing of Russophobia, as you indicated in the beginning today. So we're stepping out of the sequential history of the Soviet Union into Russia and just looking at the Western powers treatment, no, led by the United States, incitement to Russophobia. So I begin. So I'm going to ask you, Don, some questions, because I know you have facts at the tip of your fingers, and I want to do this today, if you don't mind.
Yeah, it's fine.
Okay, good. So, I begin by quoting James Petras, who teaches at SUNY Binghamton and is a prominent political analyst of the left in the alternative universe to the mainstream media, to mainstream analysts and, you know, regime scholars.
Right.
So I quote him. Recently, I think it was this August, a recent article. Mm-hmm. So he says, even crazy leaders speak truth to power. President Trump has denounced and exposed the repeated deceits and ongoing fabrication of the mass media. Never before has a president so forcefully identified the lies of the leading print and TV outlets, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Financial Times, NBC, CNN, ABC, and CBS have been thoroughly discredited in the eyes of the larger public. They have lost legitimacy and trust. Where he continues, where progressives have failed, a warmonger billionaire has accomplished speaking a truth to serve, he says, perhaps many injustices.
Right.
I'll skip the last part. But my question is, do you agree, Don, that the mass media's demonization of Russia, for example, is failing and has lost legitimacy with the public?
Well, I mean, you know, first of all, let's look at their own polling data. As recently as June, okay, and I'm surprised the numbers are this high. The mass media and Professor Petras went through a pretty exhaustive list. Fox was notably missing from that, but Fox suffers from the same numbers. The reverse way it breaks by party, but in June, a poll of 4,000 adults, roughly 4,000 adults. showed that 92% of Republicans and Republican-leaning independents said that traditional news outlets knowingly report false or misleading stories, at least sometimes, and that that's in line with other recent polls from Gallup and Pew and others. It found that independents who identify as Democrats or lean towards Democrats, 79% of them feel that way, and just outright Democrats agree by 53%. In the aggregate, 72% of Americans believe traditional major news sources report news they know to be fake, false, or purposely misleading. So, you know, now, that includes a lot of folks who, you know, went through the entire system, did everything that they were supposed to do, got rewarded for it, are still getting rewarded for it, because we're talking about three-quarters of the population, roughly, at 72%. So in there are people who chased, caught, and are sitting on top of the American dream. They also believe that the media lies. Now, people like us who pay attention to, you know, more than just our personal lives, we've been looking at the society and the things that go on, know that they lie because we've been watching them lie our whole lives. They lied about Vietnam, and then, you know, Daniel Ellsberg releases evidence that they've been lying. There's a dance that's done. A whole bunch of stuff goes on around that. They try to kill him instead of absorbing the fact that they've been lying. And, you know, there's a few million bodies that are a consequence of that. You can go down to Reagan and the whole thing that happened with Iran-Contra and all of that. And probably the best measure of the reaction to the exposure of all of that, which was not exposed by the media, is that the one media person from the independent media who exposed some of it ended up dead. And then, you know, talking about Gary Webb. Then you've got the whole thing with the Iraq War. The first Iraq War in 1990, when it turns out that the media all report this thing with babies and incubators and horrible things done by that evil, nasty Saddam Hussein. It turns out this was stuff at a press conference that came from a press handler that was a member of the royal family of Kuwait, who was looking to have the U.S. Army go back and grab a few billion dollars of the Iraqi people's oil to put it back in his bank account and put that little princess back in her palace. And then we had what happened with the media from left to right, sideways, going into the Iraq War. And again, we already had amassed 1 million or 2 million bodies before that even started, between the people that were killed in 1990-91 and then starved slowly for a decade. And the whole media lied. The whole political establishment lied. People died. They're still dying. The troops are still over there. And yet, there's really never been any accountability for all of this. Well, this all happened in front of the whole world, including even those dumb Americans. And they're finally catching on. Then the economy collapsed in 2008. And they elected a guy. They were so desperate to solve the problem, they elected the black guy. Who would have thought in 2007 that that was possible? Not that it shouldn't have happened, but knowing the Americans, the most racist society on the planet, that it did happen showed that people were willing to try anything because they didn't trust their institutions. And then he and his government and the media started telling them for the next 8 years that everything was fine now. Well, people can believe it for a little while, this because it's repeated over and over on television. But when their stomach starts saying, hey, you know, I haven't eaten in a couple of days, and by the way, we're not living indoors anymore, they notice it. And if the TV's still telling them everything's fine, they stop trusting the TV. And it got so bad that they elected the reality TV guy who did nothing up until 2016 in front of them but fire people. But he said, I'll get you a job. They said, you know what? We can't believe any of them. The media hates him. There must be something good about him. So in terms of him saying, and, you know, whether it's the phenomenon of, you know, broken clock right twice a day or whatever, when Trump says the media is the enemy of the people, the corporate, when he's talking about CNN, New York Times, Washington Post, you know, this corporate media that belongs to the billionaire set, when he calls them the enemy of the people, he's right, because they have proven themselves that repeatedly. This is not the press. This is a public relations propaganda arm of the corporate reality that we live in. And that is, in fact, the enemy of the people.
Quite right. Yes, lies. Lies have killed millions.
Millions.
And starved people at home. And so on, and you put it very well. So I want to ask you a second question, and this concerns the professional, scholarly class, the people that belong to think tanks, that write books that become bestsellers, the regime, the people I call the regime Sovietologists at Yale, Harvard, etc. And my question is that some of them, one is from Yale, Clapton, I think is his name, claims that Russia was a democracy for the first time in its history under Yeltsin. Now, we know that from these think tanks and universities, these absurdities spill into the mass media. These think tanks and intellectuals are the conduits, are the generators of what becomes mass media lies. So Russia was a democracy for the first time in its history under Yeltsin. What do you say to that?
There's a compound word that begins with bull and ends with the first part of a compound word that President Trump used to describe some other nations. It refers to a popular fertilizer, that would be the first thing that I would say. And secondly, I would say a steaming pile of it to convey the idea effectively that it may. Okay, so you have a country that is, in essence, an empire that has a bunch of people living as serfs, essentially in medieval property relations, with an industrial base also that is sort of on the periphery of the real imperial colonial powers. It's the eastern part of Europe, a large chunk of Asia. You can see London from your front steps, and from your back porch you can see Tokyo. It's called Russia. The people there have such a raw deal that in 1905 they tried to square it away, to fix it. There were people ready to take up arms and fight all over the country in 1905, and they failed. But one of the things that they did do was organize themselves into workers' councils, particularly in St. Petersburg and in Moscow and some of the other larger cities in Russia. Over a period of time, these were organized, and you essentially had working people, particularly factory workers, proletarians, learning how to govern themselves, in their own organizations, and taking care of many of the material needs of the working people that were not being met by the employers and the factories. And by 1917, in the midst of a war that had devastated not just Russia, but the whole of Europe, there was another uprising. This time it was successful. There was a multi-class group that took power in the early part of 1917. And then under the guiding hand of Lenin, the working class elements found their way to power by what would now be called November, but what they called October of 1917. Those folks then set to build an economy that they owned and a government that served them. And it lasted from then until 1990, despite being destroyed twice and threatened with nuclear devastation and surrounded and completely and totally isolated from the global economy. Despite all of that, it thrived for a very long while. Put the first people into outer space. Did so many things that, just as an aside, helped the people of Cuba remain liberated from the United States, who in turn liberated millions of people in Africa from colonialism. The tremendous things that were done by it. There were many problems in the Soviet Union. I would guess the majority of them were a consequence of the warfare that was conducted against it, which they now call third and fourth generation, as if they were recent inventions. But sanctioning of the economy, the refusal even of the United States to recognize the Soviet government for 15 years after it took power, let alone extend credits back and forth to do the normal trading that every other nation does. So I would have to say that having built an economy that they owned at the close of business in 1991, and then finding out that people were going to steal it in broad daylight from them, seeing that happen, all of a sudden people that were living indoors, eating, had enough education, healthcare, and whatever to excel, let alone to get by. Suddenly became completely and totally impoverished, insecure in every way, food, healthcare, housing, etc. I doubt any of them would refer to that period as their period of democracy.
Right. Right. Now, this is kind of a follow-up question. Question number three. Recently, New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman wrote sarcastically that Putin must be a CIA agent since he has done so much to hurt Russia. But IMF data points out that when Putin took over in 1998, per capita income was down by more than 40% since 1990s. More, this was higher than the drop in the U.S. Economy per capita during the Great Depression. Under Putin's administration, per capita income increased 115%, and average annual growth rate reached 3.9%. So how exactly has Putin served the CIA and hurt Russia, Don?
Well, first of all, if that were true, then I guess all of this money that they keep budgeting, like the 700 and some odd billion dollars that they're budgeting in the new NDAA over the last week or two, and the multi-hundreds of millions of dollars that they budgeted last year and the year before, for a partnership with Russian thief Khodorkovsky and the CIA to propagandize. In other words, all this money that's being taken from Americans who can't afford health care to protect them from the Russian menace, I guess that money actually is being stolen because Putin has taken care of the job for us. I guess that's their argument. I don't know. Maybe it is. Maybe that's true. If it is, then let's start the trials and start, prosecuting the people who are stealing that money. But it seems that they view Russia as an existential threat to their class. And somehow, with Putin having been president, he's on his third term, and he was the prime minister for a term in between. Somehow, with all of that time, in other words, he's been in power more or less since 1998, 1999, I guess that he's doing a really slow job of turning the country over to the CIA. The election earlier this year, there was a better than 76% turnout. In the United States, we have generally, 40 or 50 or something? I don't remember what we got in the 2016 U.S. presidential election, but he had 76% turnout, and he won... what was the percentage of the vote? Oh, no, I'm sorry. The turnout was 67.54%, and he won 76.69%, or almost 80% of the vote, more than three-quarters of the vote. The second best showing was by the Communist Party's candidate at 11.77%. So, you know, you had three-quarters of the people that voted, and two-thirds of every Russian of age did vote, saying, we think he's doing a swell job, let's elect him yet again. And I don't know, maybe these people know more than the Russians do about their own candidates. But, you know, in the United States, you had a turnout, yeah, it was 55% in the Clinton versus Trump, with all of the, you know, propaganda and billions of dollars spent on that campaign and on and on and on. And Trump got 46.1% of the popular vote and Clinton 48.2. So, you know, in absolute numbers, now the population, the voting population in Russia is 109 million. I forget what the population is. It's like 150 million or something.
40?
Yeah. So there's 109 million registered voters in Russia. And Putin got 56 million and change of them. Okay, there are in the United States, do they even give us the number? How many registered voters are there in the United States? I don't know, but if you got 128 million people voted altogether, and that represents about 55%. So you have, what I said, 130. So it's about 230 million eligible voters in the United States, 240 million. And the highest vote getter got 65 million. And again, Putin has, less than half the voter base, and he got about 85% of the total that they had. Mm-hmm. So I'm guessing the Russian people think he's doing just fine. And as a matter of fact, walking around Moscow, talking to people during the World Cup, as I did, that's what everyone there said. To the extent that I heard criticism, it was that he's not taking a tough enough stand with the United States doing the things that they're doing around the world. They would like to see Russia more engaged and more aggressive because, in fact, they're not aggressive at all, and they're being pushed around like the rest of the world by the United States. And Russian people, some of them, their nose is out of joint over it.
Yeah. Well, one thing that I like to point out is that the liberals, the liberal party, whatever it's called in Russia, gathered a miserable 2% of the vote. These are the leftovers from the democratic era,
right,
of, what's his name?
Yeltsin and...
Of indeed the CIA.
Right.
And if Putin is an agent of the CIA, he's costing the United States, as you pointed out, an awful lot of money, and he's not doing a very good job building up the Liberal Party. In fact, one of the things that was surprising about Grudinin and the Russian Federation Communist Party was two things. One was criticism of domestic policies, some of them pointing out facts of the slowness of things, like redeveloping the manufacturing. I don't have a list right here, but at any rate, the Russian Communist Party, which ran on its own, criticizes domestic policy, but completely adhered to Putin's foreign policy and foreign policy, foreign defensive policy against the threat of the United States and its allies,
right.
And really, really echoed Stalin's words, Stalin's position, built in the 1930s as the Nazi attack was approaching, that is, build a strong military.
Yep. Yeah, and by the way, let's put this into context here. According to just about everybody, Russia, the United States, NATO, your Aunt Mary's cousin Bob, that everyone that looks at these things, Russia's military budget is somewhere between $35 and $70 billion a year. Let's say for last year. The increase in the U.S. military budget this year over last year is almost that number. And the U.S. military budget itself is 10 times plus the highest estimate that they have of Russia. Russia, the highest one I'm looking at for 2016, that came out of Stockholm's, the International Peace Research Institute, they estimated Russia's military expenditure in 2016 at $69.2 billion. We signed off on a military budget the other day. The U.S. government, President Trump, was at $717 billion, more than $700 billion.
Well, but you have to add to that, the budget of NATO.
That's right, and the national budget,
$1 trillion.
Yeah. Right.
$750 billion contributed to by the U.S. So, think about it. 750, that's only what's on the books.
That's
750
right.
Billion military budget allocated to the Pentagon. Well, just come out of our pockets into the defense, the defense ministry or whatever you want to call it. And in addition, 750 billion to the coffers of NATO.
Hey, let's look at this. This is again from Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, okay? And but we can also, there's the Institute for Strategic Studies. I'm going to have to close on this because I can't believe it. We're almost out of time already.
Oh, dear.
The U.S. In 2017 spent $610 billion. The world total is $1.7 trillion, okay?
Yeah.
The U.S. has half of that. China, they estimated $228 billion. Saudi Arabia, $69.4 billion. Russia, $66.3 billion. India, $63.9 billion. France, $57.8 billion. UK, $47.2 billion. Japan, $45.4 billion. Germany, $44.3 billion. And South Korea, $39.2 billion. Now, out of all of that, you have Russia and the People's Republic of China on one side, so you've got shy of $300 billion, and on the other, you have about $1 trillion lined up. That is currently what's being spent on the military, and so when you're talking about who's aggressive and who's planning an aggressive move in the future, you have to say that it's the United States and its client states. And the one thing you got to remember about Trump is, as he's been talking about not the U.S. cutting back its contribution to NATO, he has been invoking the 2% requirement of the GDPs of each of the NATO countries, which they have not been contributing, as a demand. He's been saying, if you guys want us to play with you in NATO, you got to be ponying up 2% of your budget. Because Trump's big job creator thus far has been the huge arms sales to places like Saudi Arabia. I know that he doesn't plan to continue that way, but it has helped him get from here to there. And this is something that's going to change the political situation in Europe if it's really pushed, because the people of Europe will not spend. All right, we're out of time. Luciano will come back next week, maybe a little more contemporary stuff, and then we'll get back to business.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Don.
Thank you, too. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.